The Guardian.
Hey, it's Lee Alexander, and before you get started with this episode of Chips with Everything, we wanted to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now here's the show.
It's moving. It's alive.
Hey, Lee Alexander here, and welcome back for another episode of Chips with Everything. On today's show, we'll be exploring the future of medical technology and how some incredible digital advancements are rapidly improving our capabilities in the medical field every single day. To dig into this topic this week, we're lucky enough to have Dr. Hilary Jones.
Pure Genius is a new cutting-edge medical series.
He's involved in a new show on the Universal Channel called Pure Genius.
And the premise of the show is to highlight the incredible advances in medical technology, which mean that we can more accurately and more quickly diagnose conditions and target specific treatments designed for the individual that will get quicker results, more effective treatments with less side effects.
Hilary is a GP and a medical broadcaster who's been working in the medical space since 1976. He's worked in London and Tristan da Cunha, and now, alongside working as a general practitioner, he's also been the resident medical expert on a breakfast show here in the UK for the past 25 years.
My father was a GP, and I was able to see firsthand how committed he was to helping people and how appreciative his patients were. What put me off slightly were the hours he did, which was every day, every hour of every day, without a break, and things are easier these days. But I as soon as I got into hospital medicine, what I found myself doing was after the ward round, where we all stood around in white coats with the consultant pointing at the patient as if he was independent to the discussion and divorced from it, I used to find myself drifting back to the bedside explaining what the consultant had said and what the management of the condition was going to be, to make sense of it, to get rid of the fear that you could see in the patient's eyes, and I could see the patient appreciated that. So it was medical communication which made me feel like this was a rewarding career to have, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
So Pure Genius is going to deal with medical advancements, for example, like the development of cells that can join neurons together if they've been severed in something like a spinal injury. Or let's say you need an organ transplant, they can do that with 3D printing now. Or robotic surgery that is a new and more accurate way to remove tumors or do other types of things that we used to do manually.
This is not just figments of the imagination. This is not an ideological thing based on no fact whatsoever. Most of these advances are happening already. For example, we have ingestible diagnostic devices, things that we can swallow, no bigger than the size of an antibiotic capsule, which will pass through the digestive system and can not only give us images, pictures of the inside of the gut, so we can look for ulcers, we can look for cancers, we can look for inflammation, but will transmit vital signs, the heart rate, the breathing rate, which has fantastic implications for people who have severe burns where we can't attach electrodes to the outside of the body to measure heart rate. So we measure these things from within through a swallowed capsule. In turn, we might be able to create nanoparticles. These things are being worked on right now, incidentally. Nanoparticles which might be able to target viruses, fight viruses and infections, attack cancer cells. Tiny particles which move through the body, going to the heart of the problem. And we have examples of all these things right now.
So I am like a big fan of Star Trek, and one of the things that fans will remember about the programs is that in each series, the medical staff would have a device called a tricorder, and they would just kind of point it at you and wave it over your body and find out what was wrong by looking at the display.
Now, that's something that doesn't exist just now, but certain aspects of that device certainly exist right now. It combines that with the importance of the human approach to medicine, the compassion, the empathy, the human touch, the bedside manner, with that, all that allied to new technology. So technology which means we can scan externally without invasive procedures, get accurate diagnosis, and more accurately target the treatment to avoid side effects and to get better results. And you put all that together, and what you have is an amalgamation of the very best in the human approach, the compassion, and the technology. So in the future, I don't think doctors will ever be redundant themselves, because human beings will always need that emotional reassurance that somebody cares. But you ally that to technology, a little robot that can course through your body, correcting something that's gone wrong, and who knows where we might be in 10, 15, 20 years' time.
Dr. Jones says that there are even, you know, new ways to understand how the brain communicates. For example, if you put electric nodes on a patient's head, you can see their brain waves communicating and lighting up those nodes, even if the patient is in a coma or otherwise unresponsive. And it provides us with kind of new and complex ways to understand how the human brain expresses itself. That opens up its own series of ethical issues when we think about how we define life, and if the brain is expressing itself, what does that mean for the person in whom that brain lives?
I think people are fascinated by the sometimes very public debates about whether somebody is in a persistent vegetative state, in a coma. And the decision that relatives and doctors have to make together to decide whether a life support machine is switched on, or kept on, or switched off. We would like to believe in the medical profession that we always know whether somebody is truly brain dead or not before such decisions are made. But there are some famous examples of people coming out of a coma where previously all hope had been lost. And that gives people hope, rare hope, but nevertheless hope and optimism. So the brain-to-brain communication is a really interesting concept, and it has already been used. And what happens is you can attach electrodes to somebody's skull, something we call an EEG or electroencephalogram, which we similar thing we use to looking at brain waves to assess epilepsy and brain activity. And it's been shown that two people in different locations can actually communicate their thoughts through these electrodes, because the electrodes will pick up signals which are far too fast and far too subtle to be transmitted through eye movement or through hand movement or whatever. But if someone is looking at signals on flashing lights which correspond to a yes or a no, for example, somebody in the other remote locations connected to those electrodes can tell whether that somebody is saying yes or no. And that's, I suppose, the nearest thing we've ever come to telepathy. But it's telepathy being picked up by electrical communication between brains, and that's fascinating. It's far beyond my comprehension, because I'm just a simple GP. But I can kind of get the basics of it, and I can see that it has an immense potential for the future.
So one of the challenges in transplants or in mending broken body parts with, you know, external materials is that the risk of infection is high. Sometimes the body will reject those types of materials. Now, They have a new kind of material. It's called spider silk. The human body apparently doesn't reject it, and it can mend bones, it can mend fractures, it can encourage cell growth in muscle tissue like the heart, and it seems to be a new and an innovative and potentially safer way to repair certain types of internal injuries.
It is physically made from the silk spun by spiders, which is compatible with the human body. It doesn't cause rejection. But it is able to create a building block, if you like, around which bone cells can grow when there is non-union of bones. So you have a fracture and it's not healing. This material can be used to encourage new bone growth where it's needed, or new cell growth, say, in heart muscle where it's needed. And the fascinating thing is that the big challenge is not whether the stuff works. It does. It's creating enough of it. And they are now using E. coli bacteria, which formerly have been the cause of great human suffering because of it's a nasty pathogen which causes a great deal of disease. But if you can take E. coli in the lab and make these bacteria produce this spider silk in much greater quantities than you can get from other sources. So it's all about tinkering with nature and DNA to create materials that can help us to heal in the future.
So we asked Dr. Jones, how are these kinds of advancements discovered, like spider silk? Do they just kind of throw a metaphorical dart at the wall and see what sticks? Or is there a method to this experimentation and development?
It's a bit of both. You know, you experiment with substances, and you hit upon something, and then you take it from there, and you run with that, and you refine it, and you make it more sophisticated until you get the product that you want. If you look at the advancement of medicine over the years, penicillin was discovered largely by chance. The effect of certain medications have been discovered by chance. Thalidomide, which caused so much grief when it was first used and caused damage to unborn babies, is now being used as a very effective anti-cancer drug, particularly because it stops cells dividing, and in the same way that it caused stunting of limbs because it stops cells dividing and growing in the embryo, it stops cancer cells dividing. So it's about discovering how things work and then running with that concept and refining it and making it more sophisticated that we get advancement. And it's fascinating how, you know, we've seen things in medicine that have been discovered by chance, helping people today in ways that we perhaps formerly couldn't have imagined.
When we come back, Dr. Jones will be telling us about a potential advancement in the medical field that, if successful, could change how we view what humans are really capable of. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Jason Phipps here, head of audio here at The Guardian. This episode of Chips with Everything that you are enjoying, no doubt, is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Hey everyone, Chips with Everything producer Matt here, and if you're enjoying this episode of Chips, I'd like to suggest another one of The Guardian's other great shows, Close Encounters, which explores the more sexual side of human nature. Here's a clip from one of my favorite episodes.
It was a very unreal circumstance. I mean, there was pictures of Jason Donovan on the wall, which was quite strange. She asked me to take off my top, she took off hers. I was very anxious to take off my top. I didn't really want to because I didn't know what I was doing. I was so young. From what I gather, she knew everything.
Or she at least pretended
or
that
pretended
she did.
To know everything. Yeah.
That's Close Encounters. You can find it on theguardian.com, iTunes, or your favorite podcasting app. Just search for Close Encounters. Now, back to the show.
So there have been some incredible medical and technological advancements made in recent history. In the last year, new cancer vaccines and much better methods for screening for cancers have popped up. And, of course, in the past 100 years or so, we've had insulin, anesthesia, X-ray technology. Those are things that have had massive impacts on society and our health. But even so, there are some potential developments in the cards that Hillary says would be a sort of man-on-the-moon moment for medicine if it succeeds. It's the kind of thing we've only seen possible in horror or sci-fi movies up until now. A full-on head transplant. Old head, new body. Hillary met with the man who's not only interested in having his head transplanted onto a new body, he's actively coordinating with an Italian doctor to make it a reality.
He's a Russian engineer by the name of Valery, which was ironic because my name's Hillary, so two guys with girls' names. How about that? We met together at on Good Morning Britain, and this guy, who's a terrific guy, has been severely disabled from birth, and he dreams of having a normal body. And he has consulted with an Italian neurosurgeon who feels that it is absolutely feasible to transplant somebody else's body onto his head. He believes he can reattach the spinal cord and make it functional, reattach all the arteries and veins in the neck, the muscles, the spine itself, the bones of the spine, and give Valerie a better quality of life. Now, not everybody agrees. Of course, it's never been done before. It's been tried on animals with varying degrees of success. And it's possible that one day he will get ethical approval to do this, probably not in the UK, but possibly elsewhere. And we'll see how this develops. Many people think that the professor who wants to do this is a kind of Frankenstein. The patient himself feels that he would like to be part of a pioneering surgical operation. He compares himself to some of the earlier recipients of heart transplantation. In the early days, it wasn't very successful. Today, it's almost routine. So who knows? One day we could restore spinal cords that have been severed and ruptured. The idea of reattaching in a functional way the billions of nerve cells which transmit messages from the brain to the rest of the body in our very complex organism, the human body, would be an absolute man on the moon moment, and probably the greatest procedure, if it was successful, ever known to medicine, greater than the discovery of penicillin, of course, greater than the answer to tuberculosis, probably akin to a universal cure for cancer. Certainly it's a story that's going to be followed with immense interest by the medical and surgical profession. In our TV debate on this, it was quite a short debate, and he was on a live link from Italy, and I was in a London studio. I did express my skepticism about whether this operation could work, he did point out that he thought I was particularly ignorant on the subject, and hadn't read his paper, and I suggested that perhaps the person needing the brain transplant should have been him. So we did differ on this. I am more skeptical about the possible success of such a procedure, which, as he sees it, would be conducted in a massive operating theatre involving several teams of doctors and specialists. So there would be a specialist team of, say, 10 to 15 neurosurgeons involved in restoring function to nerves. There would be a vascular team, again, maybe 10, 15, 20 specialists reattaching arteries like the carotid, jugulars, all the important arterial and cardiovascular structures in the neck. There would be the need for people restoring the bones and the muscles, ligaments. And all this quite apart from the need to freeze the brain to stop the cells in the brain metabolizing and requiring oxygen, because once you cut off the blood supply, of course, to the brain, you die in most conventional circumstances. So you need to keep the brain alive, and that would involve freezing the head. And again, this is very experimental stuff. There's a lot of ifs and buts. It's not a procedure I would like to go through any time soon, I have to say. But the professor thinks it's all possible, and no doubt he's calling on experience of animal procedures which have shown different degrees of success. I suppose, as with everything, there are degrees of risk. And if you're the patient and your life is, for whatever reason, miserable, incomplete, and you understand the risks and the potential benefits, it's between the surgeon and the patient, provided you've got full informed consent. And I say informed consent, that's really important there. Then it's between the patient and the surgeon to make decisions as to whether the procedure goes ahead.
That is absolutely amazing. Even if this particular operation doesn't actually go through, or if it happens and it doesn't, you know, turn out the way we'd hope, the fact that we're even able to conceive the idea of performing an operation like this is absolutely incredible. It's amazing just to think about how far technology can drive medicine and vice versa. And so what are some of the things that Dr. Jones is excited about personally in the medical field? Some of it is drawn from his own experience, and some of it looks a bit further ahead.
In 1976, I used to play a lot of sport, and I still do. And I tore a cartilage in my left knee, and I had that operated on at the time through open surgery. So they actually opened my joint and took the cartilage away, and it took me about 4 months to recover and rehabilitate from that. So many years later, 2004. I tore a cartilage on my right knee, but I had keyhole surgery then, not open surgery, and the recovery was about a quarter of the time, 1 month. And I've had procedures in recent years which have used new technology. Recovery has been incredibly quick, mainly sports injuries. And so I've been on the receiving end of new technology, and I embrace that. But of course, as an old-fashioned GP, I'm wary of new technology. I don't find it easy to put my trust in machines. And whilst I'm aware that human error is a factor in medicine, I also know how often my laptop crashes and I can't rely on it. So I embrace new technology where it's tempered with reliability and somebody human watching over it. And I guess it'll take a lot to persuade me any other way.
That's all for this week's episode. Thanks again to Dr. Hilary Jones for coming on and helping us bridge the gap between medicine and technology. If you like this show, you can subscribe on iTunes or whatever podcasting app you like to use on your phone. Just search for Chips with Everything. And while you're at it, definitely please feel free to leave us a review. You can follow me on Twitter at Lee Alexander, and my producer Matt is on Twitter at Matt Shore. And on that note, just a heads up that I will be off for the next few weeks, but as he's done a couple times in the past, Matt will be stepping in with some help from our Science Weekly producer, Max Sanderson. You'll be in good hands with them. Until then, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you back here next week.
The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs.
To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com. Also, subscribe to the Guardian Live podcast. You can do so on iTunes, SoundCloud, and other reputable audio platforms.